Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble, sitting in for Ann today. We've got a little music here from the Buchanan Brothers. It's a top hit with the Atomic Power. It was recorded in 1946.
Atomic power, atomic power, was given by the mighty hand of God. Atomic power, atomic power, it was given by the mighty hand of God.
That's just one example of how atomic power has had an almost mythical status in the American consciousness, but will it be a part of our future? Joining us now is the author of a new book, The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. Welcome to the show, Craig Nelson.
Thank you so much, Mandy.
Great. We're glad you're here today. Thanks for being here. So let's start with a little history about nuclear energy. In your book, you describe the untold story of Marie Curie and how she almost wasn't the scientific pioneer we know today. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I love this story so much. Once upon a time, there was a little girl named Manya, who was the youngest of five children of a family that had once been prosperous, but had fallen on hard times. And when she was about 17, her oldest sister, Bronya, said, "Manya, let's make a deal. You go to work for 2 years and support me while I go to school, and then I'll turn around and return the favor." And this was an especially wild proposition at that time, because it was illegal for women to be educated past around the age of 12. And both Bronya and Manya were getting around that by attending something called the Floating University, which floated so that the authorities couldn't track down who was running it and throw him or her in a labor camp. But the Floating University did an incredible job, and Bronya got into medical school at the University of Paris, the Sorbonne, and off she went, and off Manya went to be a nanny. And we have fantastic letters from Manya's first jobs with working for people she hates. They're really vicious, nasty letters. And then finally she lands with this wonderful family called the Zarovskis. And the Zarovskis run a sugar beet plantation about 60 clicks outside of Warsaw. And they just love her. It's a beautiful home. It's a beautiful environment. The children love her. The parents love her. Everyone just is in love with Manya. And then the oldest son, Kazimir, comes home from school. And he and Manya fall head over heels in love. And after a year of romance, he tells her, "You know, I'm going to tell my parents that we're getting married." And he goes up to the parents, and all the kids know about it. They're all excited because everyone loves Manya. But the parents say, "No, we will not allow you to marry her. You're not marrying a penniless nobody. You're marrying someone of your station." And Kazimir goes back to Manya and says, "Please wait, please wait. I know I can talk them into it." And they date secretly for another 6 months, and the parents find out and fire her. So she's thrown back, have to live with her father back in Warsaw, and she's just heartbroken. She's now 19, and she's completely devastated. And then the letter arrives from Bronya. "I finished school. I'm engaged to be married. It's your turn now. Come to Paris." But she can't. She just can't go because she's so in love with Kazimir. Finally, a letter from Kazimir arrives saying, "Forget it. My parents will never allow us to marry. It's never going to work out." And off she goes to Paris, heartbroken. Many years later, Kazimir would become a famous mathematician in Warsaw. And he would frequently be seen staring up at the immense statue in the middle of Warsaw's main square of the country's national hero, Marie Curie, which is who Manya grew up to be.
Wow, that's a really interesting story. You also mention another prolific female scientist, Lisa Meitner. What was her role in the founding of nuclear energy, Craig?
Well, Lisa Meitner is one of the most important pioneers in the history of science, and she was written out of history by the Nazis for being a Jew and by the post-war Germans for being a woman. And part of my sort of spiritual reasons for being a historian is bringing back the memory of the dead and forgotten people we should honor and know today. And so I'd like to tell you her story. Lisa Meitner was the second woman to receive an advanced degree in the 500-year history of the University of Vienna. She was the first woman, she was the first female university professor in the history of Germany. After 12 years of running the physics department of the most prestigious research institute in the world, she was forced out of Germany for being of Jewish ancestry, and she ended up in Sweden working for a man who hated her, not being able to speak Swedish, and seeing her entire professional life, which she had dedicated everything to, completely washed away. It's 1938. It's Christmas Day. She's 60 years old. She's all washed up. She could not be more forlorn and upset. And her nephew, Otto Robert, comes to visit her in Sweden for Christmas. And first, the two of them eat a disgusting meal called lutefisk. And I'm Norwegian, so I can say this. For those of you who have not tasted lutefisk, it's sort of like a beef jerky that you get at the 7-Eleven, except that it has the consistency of Jell-O and it's made with fish. It is literally the worst thing I've ever put in my mouth. And I put tarantula legs in my mouth. But anyway,
doesn't sound tasty.
A delightful meal of lutefisk. They go off for a walk in the snow. And they are pondering the great mystery that is going on back in Berlin with Lise's ex-colleague Otto Hahn, a villainous chemist. Now, Otto Hahn keeps firing neutrons at uranium, and he keeps producing barium. And they can't figure out what's going wrong, because normally when you fire neutrons at a product to artificially irradiate it, which is what Marie Curie's daughter, Irene, discovered, it will move that element a little bit up or down on the periodic table. So you get an isotope right next to it. In this case, he's firing it at uranium, and he's coming with barium, which is way down the table, and it doesn't make sense. So they assume that their instruments are wrong or their chemistry is wrong. And Lise Meitner sits down on a snow-covered log and takes out a piece of paper and a pencil, and she thinks about Niels Bohr's water drop model of the nucleus, that perhaps if you hit it in just the right way, it could actually split. Then she takes the numbers for uranium and barium, and there's something left over. So she applies E equals MC2 to what's left over, and she produces this enormous amount of energy from this nuclear split, and all of the calculations fit perfectly. And when Otto Robert goes back to Copenhagen, where he works, he asks his neighbor, a biologist, what do you call it when bacteria splits? And the neighbor said fission. So what Lise Meitner discovered was fission. And almost immediately on her discovery, everyone in the world thought, what if Adolf Hitler had a bomb based on this?
Well, and let's fast forward some years to the test run at Los Alamos. You know, many scientists involved in the nuclear bomb's development, they had some second thoughts about their efforts. One scientist said, it's a terrible thing that we've made. And there was even a petition created to encourage President Harry Truman to think about his moral responsibilities about the bomb. You wrote in your book that the things we're working on are so terrible that no amount of protesting or fiddling with politics will save our souls. Can you shine a little bit of light on that for us?
It's really quite amazing that from the very beginning, the man who convinced Einstein to write a letter to FDR, which started the Manhattan Project, was a Hungarian emigre named Leo Szilard, and he was this wild character. I mean, he literally is one of another great forgotten character in history. And he co-invents the first nuclear reactor, which Enrico Fermi powers up in the middle of an abandoned football stadium in the middle of Chicago. And at that moment, when the nuclear reactor works, Szilard says, this is a dark day for humanity. Not even starting on being able to make a bomb yet, just being able to make power from a nucleus. He already feels that way. And one of the most wonderful ironies of all of this is that Szilard eventually writes a collection of short stories, and in one of them, the United States has a nuclear war and loses it, and the scientists are prosecuted as war criminals. And Andrei Sakharov and his colleagues back in the Soviet Union working on thermonuclear weapons read this story and realized how easily it could apply to them, and it's how Andrei Sakharov became a dissident.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, where we're discussing nuclear power and whether it's going to be a part of our future with the author of The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era, Craig Nelson. Craig, you mentioned the efficiency of the nuclear bomb when used in war compared to other methods. You say it was efficient. Talk about that a little bit. How was the nuclear bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki efficient?
Well, we have an entire mythology about nuclear weapons. Some of it is Marvel Comics, where nuclear things make Spider-Man. I mean, there's this whole series of superheroes that are made from nuclear. And then we have all those horror movies, the giant ant taking over everywhere done nuclear. And then we have the Armageddon shows like Dr. Strangelove and On the Beach. But in fact, the only difference between a nuclear weapon and a traditional weapon is the incredible power of the explosion, the massive amount of heat that's produced, the fact that it looks staggering, it makes a very impressive explosion to look at, and that it creates a radioactive fallout. And besides that, there's no difference. And so, for example, before we dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, we had been firebombing Japan, and we had completely decimated 60 of Japan cities. And so I was able to calculate using the ratio of acreage destroyed that if the United States wanted, instead of dropping a bomb on Hiroshima, it could have just sent 210 planes dropping fire bombs and achieved the same thing. So the efficiency is the fact that you have one big giant bomb. But other than that, our fantasies about nuclear are really fantasies.
There's a contrary, I guess you could say, to the bomb's efficiency. It was discovered that it wasn't necessarily an effective tool because despite the devastation that the bomb caused on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, they still didn't surrender after that. What was reaction from the, I mean, could you consider that a success if you know, Japan didn't immediately surrender? Would it be an effective tool then?
Well, what's amazing about history is how we get information and we can completely change our minds about historical facts. So what has happened with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is that first, the Japanese had already lost 60 cities. So losing 61 and 62, even though the bomb was quite awesome to look at and had this radioactive element, wasn't enough to make them surrender. Secondly, it turns out that though Truman was very gung-ho about the atomic bomb, none of his military chiefs thought he should use it. Eisenhower was against it. Marshall, the head of the Army, was against it. And Arnold and King, the head of the Air Force and the Navy, were all against it. So King assumed that, you know, all of Japan's naval shipping had been shut down and soon the country would be starved. So for decades, we've been told that these bombs ended World War II. But in fact, I was able to find information for this book on how people admitted that, in fact, the use of the bombs was to demonstrate this technological achievement and to cow Stalin. Stalin was in the middle of gobbling up Eastern Europe, and they wanted to do something to put him in his place. So you can think of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings not as the end of the World War II, but as the beginnings of the Cold War.
That's right. We are going to take a quick break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Age of Radiance and the epic rise and dramatic fall of the atomic era. Will it be in our future? Stay tuned. We'll speak with Craig Nelson when we come back.
Are you ready? Are you ready for the great atomic power? Will you rise and meet your savior in the air? Will you shout or will you cry when the fire ain't from on high? Are you ready for the great atomic power?
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble sitting in for Ann today. That's a little bit of the Leuven Brothers 1952 gospel classic, Great Atomic Power. Atomic power has been an almost mythical status in the American consciousness, but is it a part of our future? Still with us is the author of The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era, Craig Nelson. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you again.
If you have any questions about the atomic bomb, nuclear energy, where it's going, you can give us a call at 292-8513. That's 614-292-8513. Or email us, allsides@wosu.org. Craig, when we hear the words nuclear energy, we often think of the Cold War, nuclear weapons, not necessarily health care, but nuclear energy has led powerful medical breakthroughs. Can you talk a little bit about how and when nuclear energy went from kind of being just in the military arsenals into health care?
Well, Eisenhower really wanted to show this technology as being not just for bombs. He really felt that it was a magical, wonderful thing that had been discovered, and he created a program called Atoms for Peace, where atomic power was used to power, it began to power submarines, it began to bear in plants, and it began to, allowed isotopes to be exported all over the globe, which are used in nuclear medicine. And in fact, Marie Curie was given a Nobel Prize for discovering radium, and her daughter Irene was given one for discovering artificial radioactivity, the first and second women to ever achieve the Nobel Prize. And that artificial radioactivity, combined with the tracer technique, is the cornerstone of nuclear medicine, which is as important to us today as the microscope. It appears over and over and over again to either in diagnostics or in treatment. And so it really is something that is saving lives and is the one very good side of this whole story to not forget to talk about.
Nuclear energy has other uses in everyday life as well outside of medicine. We've got food preservation, insect control, smoke detectors, and of course electricity, which we'll get to in a bit. Can you talk a little bit about the everyday applications of nuclear energy?
Well, I think the one that people are most interested in and excited about is carbon-14 dating, so that anytime we unearth something that's old out of the ground, we can date it because of that carbon-14. So I think that's probably besides nuclear medicine, that's the one that appears to most people.
And of course, all of this means, like you were talking earlier about nuclear medicine, we've got mammography, x-rays, radioactive material that's injected into patients. And what this means for us is we're all exposed to radiation at some level. And you write in your book that the CDC reports everyone born after 1951 in the U.S. has been exposed to radiation from the Nevada test site. And here we are nearly 70 years later, and we're still feeling the effects of that first nuclear bomb test. I just found that absolutely remarkable. What does all of that mean for all of us and where we kind of fit in the picture with nuclear energy?
Well, the two amazing things I discovered, two of the amazing things I discovered in my research, I should back up and say that, were the studies that had been done on the Hibakusha, the people who survived Nagasaki and Hiroshima, as well as this news you just mentioned about the Nevada test site. So let's do the somewhat good news first. The people who survived the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have been studied every year ever since that happened. So we now have one of the only long-term pieces of data we have on the human effects of nuclear is this. And, you know, if you had asked me what had happened to those people, I would assume that they had huge death rates, that they've had genetic mutations, that they have huge cancer rates, and none of that is true. The people who survived the atomic bombing have an incidence of cancer 1% higher than the regular population of Japan, and they have no genetic disorders at all. So, you know, when you think about all this time we've been terrified of the very word nuclear. I mean, if you said the word radioactive to me before I started working on this book, I would immediately think danger, cancer, infection, sinister, all these things. It turns out we've been all worried about 1%, and those are people who are attacked by nuclear bombs. All right,
but what about the folks who were living in or near the nuclear test site? Wasn't there a large number of cancer? The folks who got cancer who might have been downwind. I was just looking through the book here that of the folks who had been exposed to that, which includes you and me and anyone else who was born after 1951, that the nearly 600,000 Americans dying of cancer every day, 11,000 will die from the remnants of those bomb tests?
Yes, that was the other amazing thing I was just about to bring up, that the Cold War test that we ran in Nevada has contaminated the entire continental United States. And finally, the people living downwind, as well as miners, notably Navajos, have been able to get some compensation for all that. It took, you know, almost 40 years for that to happen. But now the CDC estimates that 11,000 Americans will die this year because of the remnants of those bomb tests.
Let's take a quick call. Jerry from Columbus. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Thank you. Very interesting show. I'd like to point out that oil is one of the motivating factors, because the Japanese could get no oil from their own islands. It had to be all shipped up by tanker from South Java and so forth. And if you read Volume 5, War in the Pacific, from Her Majesty's Stationery Service in London, England, I don't know if you can get a copy of it here, tells that by 1943, only 15% of the oil tankers were getting through to Japan. 44, it was down to 10%. 45, practically zip. The Navy submarines were sending these tankers to Davy Jones's locker, if you follow me. And I'd like to add one more thing, and that is that Albert Einstein, because of his splitting the atom and leading to nuclear energy, before he died, he said he wished he'd been a locksmith.
Thanks for the
call. I don't know the locksmith quote, Jerry, but I know you're absolutely right about the first part of it, that the Japanese, because they did not have their own fuel, invaded southern Indochina to get those oil fields, and then they attacked Pearl Harbor to defend those oil fields. So that's part one. And then part two, the United States exported nuclear power plants to Japan to help them with the same problem. So both Pearl Harbor and Fukushima resonate with what you've just discussed. I don't know the locksmith quote, but I do know a quote from Einstein that if he had known Hitler was never going to get the bomb, he wouldn't have lifted a finger.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're speaking with Craig Nelson. He's the author of The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. We're trying to get at whether nuclear power is in our future. Craig, you say that the dark history of nuclear energy has been overblown. I wonder how, because we are still feeling the effects, as we talked about a moment ago, about the radiation from the Nevada test site. How has the dark history, if you will, of nuclear energy been overblown? Can you explain that for our listeners?
Sure, Mandy. If you go through your Google News, you can find out that you can have hundreds of thousands of articles in the U.S. press about the Fukushima nuclear disaster, and very few articles about the tsunami that caused that disaster. And in that particular incident, 18,000 people died from the tsunami, and no one has died from Fukushima. So there's that part. I also like to say that Americans learned about nuclear science from seeing pictures and movies of the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then they learned about nuclear power from the coincidence of Three Mile Island having its meltdown, alongside the China Syndrome, the movie about nuclear meltdown that was playing in theaters at the same time, which led to the biggest civil disobedience in American history, a 1 million protest gathering against nuclear in Central Park.
So is this just a bad PR campaign, if you will, that Americans have been fed? Would that be your take on that?
Well, my take is that nuclear is better than coal and it's better than oil. And because of fracking, it's better than natural gas. But the industry and the government has done such a terrible job every time we have one of these crises in mishandling everything and in appearing in such a fashion that we can never really feel like we can trust them to handle these things in the future, that I think they've destroyed nuclear power. At this point, nuclear power needs government money, as in taxpayer money, to build a plant. It needs taxpayer money to subsidize its kilowatt hours because they're too expensive. And it needs massive taxpayer money if something goes wrong. And that's why my book subtitle is The Fall of the Atomic Age, because I believe that unless there is a technological breakthrough that makes us really believe in nuclear power all over again, like that song you've been playing, it's on its way out.
We're speaking with Craig Nelson. He's the author of The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. And it sounds like, Craig, you think that nuclear power is on its way out. There are 65 nuclear power plants in America. That's what I hope those numbers are right. They generate about 790 billion kilowatts from 104 commercial nuclear reactors. Since 1990, nuclear power has supplied about 20% of our electricity. I mean, that sounds like a pretty high rate of consumption there, but I think the consumption's much lower. Only 8% of all energy consumed in the U.S. comes from nuclear power. Am I right about that?
Yes, at Fukushima, it was, at Three Mile Island, we had 20% of electricity produced by nuclear, and it has just fallen ever since. So in America, it really clearly is on the way out.
We've got a caller here, Paul, from Reynoldsburg. What's your question?
Well, yes, I want to discuss with your guest the idea of thorium energy, which was interesting. That was on your news this morning, someone proposing using thorium reactors versus the plutonium and uranium reactors. The advantages of plutonium, as I understand it, is the leftover materials are not radioactive. They're only dangerous for about 100 years versus tens of thousands for the other reactors. They cannot make fissionable materials for atomic weapons from it. Also, that the thorium cannot have a meltdown, which was on your news program this morning.
Right.
Real briefly, my brother's a lobbyist for energy industry, and I asked him about thorium, and he said, hold it.
Oh, you're cutting out, Paul.
Sorry, he said the uranium lobby is so strong.
Paul, I'm going to have to we're going to have to drop you. You were cutting out there, but I was going to ask you about this later. Craig, are you still with me?
Yes, I'm
great,
happy to address those issues.
So, yeah, I was going to bring this up later in the hour, but Paul brought that up now. We did have a report this morning that a group here in Ohio was promoting what it calls safer and cheaper nuclear reactor. It would use thorium rather than solid enriched uranium, and their theory is that it makes it safer since the thorium is already molten and can't melt down, so the risk of a meltdown is very slim. What are your thoughts on that, Craig?
Well, I really believe that the only way the nuclear energy industry can save itself is through a technological breakthrough. And there's a number of different people working on that potential. But unfortunately, they've been working on for many, many, many years, and we haven't seen much progress. And that's why I believe that thorium reactors does have a history of failure, and that's why they stopped being developed some time ago. They're a class called a breeder reactor, which creates its own fuel, and this sort of magical thing where the half-life of your fuel turns into the half-life of another fuel and then turns back into the half-life of your fuel. But those are never successful either. But there are some promising things in that China is working on something called a pebble bed reactor, where the fissile material is encased in graphite, which means that there's no way it could really melt down. And China desperately needs to get off petrochemicals, as anyone who's been to Beijing can tell you. It looks like nuclear winter there because the pollution is so dreadful from using coal. And then secondly, Bill Gates is supporting something called a traveling water reactor, which I don't, the details about its technology haven't been very much released, so I don't know what to say about that. And then there's a fusion, which is being developed by ITER in France. And so there are all these things that we may be able to get to a new level of nuclear power that is safe and is economically feasible. I sure hope so. So far, the prognosis doesn't look good.
But does it take a while to kind of get the ball rolling on these new things, to get federal approval? And then by the time, especially with this thorium reactor, at that point, would it be obsolete? Does it just take too long to get these kinds of new things started?
Well, the people who have been trying to do fusion, which is the energy that powers the sun and is the source of our thermonuclear bombs, have always said, oh, if we only had an Apollo program for fusion, it would work. But if you add up all the money the United States has spent on fusion, it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars. So, and I believe the thorium reactor issue has been investigated since the Atoms for Peace program with Eisenhower. So it's not, this isn't, the pebble bed is actually an engineering solution, and I'm praying that works. But these other things have all been in development for a very long time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble sitting in for Ann. Today we're talking about nuclear power and where it stands in our future with the author of The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era, Craig Nelson. I'm going to go to the phones for just a moment. Karen from Akron, you're on the air. You wanted to talk about Germany a little bit?
And Enrico Fermi started in Germany with his experimentation, and it was right around the time when World War II, Hitler was getting his troops cranked up, and he was married to a Jewish lady, and so once they started, Hitler started to express anti-Semitism, he and his wife escaped to Italy, and he continued his experimentation down there. But then the Germans, as we all remember, started coming over the Alps. So they had to get out of Italy. So he applied to several universities in the United States and was accepted by more than a handful. And that's how he ended up in the United States. So if it weren't for the anti-Semitic intentions of Adolf Hitler, he probably would have ended up with the first atomic bomb.
Thanks for the thank you for the call, Karen. What do you think he would have wound up with the first atomic bomb, or was this always in the hands of the U.S.?
Well, Karen's story was very close, but the real story is even more dramatic. What happened is that Fermi was Italian, and he was a major figure in the high society of Italy. In fact, he lived so close to Mussolini that one day his son was out with the maid, and they bumped into Mussolini and Hitler in the park. So he was really a member of high society Italian. He had a title of Your Excellency, and Bohr called him and said, guess what? You're about to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, not Peace Prize, Nobel Prize in Physics, excuse me. Sometimes I really do put my foot in my mouth. But anyway,
okay.
The laws, the anti-Jewish laws that Hitler had passed were now being passed by Mussolini, and Fermi was very familiar with what had happened to his colleagues in Germany. So he decided that his family would immediately go from getting their Nobel Prize, which they did with Pearl Buck, the American author of The Good Earth, and immediately decamped to America. So he ended up as a what was called an enemy alien when Japan declared war against the United States. And he was living in Leonia, New Jersey, a place on the Palisades. So when he was called an enemy alien, he took all of his Nobel Prize money and buried it in a pipe in his basement.
Very interesting. Well, Craig, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mandy Trimble. Stay tuned. More talk of nuclear energy coming up. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mandy Trimble sitting in for Ann today. In its history, atomic power has been both praised as a source of energy and criticized for the dangers it poses to human health. The reasons for those concerns were never more clear than after the reactor meltdowns at the Fukushima power plant in Japan in 2011. If you have some questions, we're talking about nuclear power this hour and where it sits, where it fits into our future. If you have a comment or a question about this topic, give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can shoot us a quick email at allsides@wosu.org. Still with us is the author of The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era, Craig Nelson. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Mandy.
Many people think nuclear energy can only have devastating results to the world and its people in regards to both war and nuclear power meltdowns. And following the disaster at Fukushima, Japan shut down its last working nuclear reactor. Also, both Germany and Switzerland began to phase out their nuclear power, joining about 15 other countries to renounce nuclear power. So, you know, a lot of people say that nuclear power is the future, but we have a lot of countries who are kind of moving away from that. What should we take away from that, Craig?
Well, it's a giant conflict because France and the people of France love nuclear power. They actually produce a surplus of energy with it. And the entire political failure we had in trying to set up a nuclear waste facility in Nevada, the French very happily set up in a town they have there, and the residents of that town are perfectly happy to have their waste program there. So you can see very different attitudes about this all over the world. One of the most crucial is the fact that both China and Vietnam are building a tremendous number of reactors, and for them, it will be a terrific step up because they're using coal, and they are really destroying the world with their coal at this point. So that's got to be an improvement. But then on the other hand, of course, if anyone knows how to have an ecological catastrophe, it's the Chinese. So I have very mixed feelings about all this, as you can tell.
Right, right. And, I mean, nuclear energy is very efficient when it's compared to how much coal or natural gas that it takes to create the same amount of energy. Where exactly, I know that you said earlier that it's kind of on its way out, but does it fit anywhere into our future at all?
Well, and Mike, one of the criticisms of my book is that I wrote such page-turning, nail-biting descriptions of Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and Fukushima, and then explained all the reasons to defend nuclear power and how dare I. But in fact, when there are not accidents, it's a fantastic source of energy because it releases no greenhouse gases. But at this point in time, because of the mishandling of those crises, and because of it requires political capital to make it work effectively, I just think it's faltering right now. You know, really, it's completely collapsing in the United States. Germany is trying to get away from it entirely. It's one of the first times that there has been a huge political contretemps in Japan, where there isn't much of a history of civil disobedience. So unless there is this technological breakthrough, I think we're seeing the twilight years of atomic energy.
And you mentioned the fallouts that have taken place over the past several decades, and I think that's what makes people so fearful is the ramifications and everything that comes after these fallouts. But I think I was reading that as a result of some of these, more safeguards have been in place because, as you mentioned, it is very safe if it's done right. If you know, we don't have these meltdowns, is there a possibility that there could be some improvements
Absolutely. But one thing people have to understand is that we hear about all these frightening things going on with what might happen with Fukushima and all these kinds of things. But what actually happens as far as its effects on human beings never seems to be discussed. For example, with Chernobyl, which is the worst nuclear disaster of all time because the Soviets were using that nuclear reactor to make plutonium for nuclear weapons, as well as electricity for the citizens of Kiev. So they did not have a containment dome to protect their neighbors from fallout. They just had this little concrete shield. So when it blew up and raged as an atomic fire for 2 weeks, it set a cloud the size of 400 Hiroshimas across all of Europe. And even after that catastrophe, the UN could only find 75 deaths, most of whom were plant workers who were directly exposed to the radiation, and firefighters who were also directly exposed. The people who were not directly exposed were the children of families who did not evacuate the territory and who drank the milk of tainted cows.
Could you argue though, that it had economic death, though, because they're still spending billions of dollars to pay out in health benefits and such matter that came out of Chernobyl?
Yes, but the ironic end to that story is the fact that a number of people disagree with the UN's assessments. They say that many more people are going to die of cancer than that. And one man has said that he is certain that at least 16,000 Europeans will die because of cancer from that fallout. And that number is an amazing coincidence, because every year in the United States, because of airborne pollution coming from using coal to make electricity, 16,000 Americans die.
As I mentioned earlier, there are 65 nuclear power plants in America. 36 of those plants have two or more reactors, supplying about 20% of our electricity here in the States. Some people say we're going to have to eventually turn to nuclear power, nuclear energy, because of the finite fossil fuels. You continue to say that nuclear power is on its way out. What would it take to ramp it up?
Well, if one of these technological breakthroughs happens and it becomes economically competitive so that it doesn't require taxpayer support at every stage, you know, if one of these plants was proved to be perfectly safe and did not produce any waste and was no danger to you or your children, I think we would welcome nuclear back. Because between greenhouse gases and eventually running out of coal and petroleum, we do need to find some other energy source. And unfortunately, the technology of renewables is just not efficient enough yet to really supplant things with wind and solar.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about nuclear power this hour. We've got Craig Nelson with us. He's the author of The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. I'm going to go to the phones here for a moment. John in Upper Arlington. John, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to note that in your discussion about the cost of nuclear energy and the safety of it, that there's been a huge oversight in that the life cycle of a power plant includes not just constructing and running it, but also taking it down, and that decommissioning process will cost more for each plant than it costs to build in the first place. And there are huge hazards associated with the extremely radioactive spent fuel, and right now a lot of that fuel is just sitting at each reactor. There is no long-term plan for what to do with it all. The hazards in the long run of this stuff escaping into the environment are huge, and that's not being considered.
All right, John, thanks for the call. Craig, John makes a good point. He's talking about nuclear waste, kind of what happens to that and the tear down of these plants. I know that a lot of this waste is just kind of sitting underground. Is that the largest roadblock? Is that one of the largest roadblocks that's prohibiting nuclear power in America, at least, to kind of take off or increase?
Well, actually, this really scary story coming out of Fukushima was not the fact that it had a meltdown, which is bad enough, but the fact that they almost had a meltdown of their radioactive waste, their used fuel rods, which were stored more or less unprotected in these open pools. And the pumps carrying that water to cool them off stopped working, and that water almost boiled away. This is a problem in 12 American power plants, where we have this radioactive waste sitting in these pools. So the scary part of Fukushima is more those pools. The second thing that's alarming is the fact that we have a massive transportation infrastructure of trucks and trains carrying nuclear materials between various nuclear reactor sites, the WIP disposal, which is low-level radiation in New Mexico, the Livermore, Sandia, and Los Alamos, the labs that work with nuclear weapons. And so when people say, oh, what about dirty bombs? Are terrorists going to use dirty bombs? Well, I can't imagine that, you know, the worst attack in American history was done with box cutters, and we're going to go from box cutters to nuclear science. But there is an issue with that massive transportation network of nuclear materials traveling all over the continental United States.
Craig, we've got an email from Kevin who wants to know what your opinion on modular reactors are, which modular reactors are supposed to decrease, he says, the footprint and cost of nuclear plants by utilizing technology similar to nuclear submarine designs. He says it's being developed by many major energy companies, including one here in Ohio. Modular reactors, what do you think about those?
Well, in fact, all reactors in the United States are based on the submarine design, and that is why, even though people think Three Mile Island was a catastrophe, it wasn't, and we actually haven't had a serious nuclear accident in the United States that's imperiled anybody. The power plant in the atomic submarines have been an entire, I guess they're now around their 50-year mark. They have never been a problem at all. So the first of all, we already have the submarine technology. But secondly, modular is what Bill Gates is trying to develop, and is what is also being used now to create isotopes in hospitals so that they don't have this tremendous cost of shipping these medical supplies all over the place. So that is a wonderful future. Perhaps that is a wonderful future thing, but it's still in its infancy in a certain way.
We're going to take to the phones again. Don in Mechanicsburg, you're on the air.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Thanks for being here.
I wanted to point out that everybody says renewables will never help us, but they've proven themselves to be very good. Germany is one of the most energy efficient countries on the planet, and they're doing it all with renewables and super insulation, which is reducing the use of energy in their buildings by 90%. And there seems to be no interest in that method here in the United States. But it can be done, and some experiments are underway with new turbines that have magnetically suspended shafts and other things. They may run for centuries without maintenance. So this is a future people need to pay attention to.
All right, Don. Thanks for the call. Craig, are we not paying enough attention to renewable energy like solar power?
Well, I'm not hearing good news from Germany. I'm hearing that they're having terrible problems switching over because I don't have the numbers in front of me, but someone said that in order to switch to all renewable for England, for Britain, you would have to cut energy consumption in half, and then you would have to have a solar farm the size of London in a desert somewhere because it's too cloudy in England to have solar, and you would have a wind farm the size of Wales. So that the efficiency issue of how much electricity gets produced by these things compared to the massive infrastructure they require at this time is a problem. Hopefully in the future they will fix that and we will be able to use those things and to produce much more of our energy. And of course, I agree with the caller that insulation and energy savings is something we really could be working a lot more on in the United States.
All right. And like we were mentioning earlier, this, I guess, the thorium molten salt reactor, that you're not too keen on that?
It's a theoretical possibility. It's just too early to know if what people say is going to happen is going to happen.
All right. Craig Nelson, we've been speaking with him this whole hour. He's the author of The Age of Radiance, The Epic Rise and Dramatic Fall of the Atomic Era. Craig, thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you, Mandy. It's been great.
It's been great having you. I'm Mandy Trimble, sitting in for Ann Fisher on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The All Sides staff includes producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants from Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Heider, and Leticia Wiggins. Thanks for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher today. I'm Mandy Trimble. This is 89.7 NPR News.